Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is lecture 4, Exposure Continued. So if you'll notice, we passed out assignment 2 today. You can find the PDF online, or if you have a copy here, you can also read through it if you would like. And assignment 1 was due today about 6.5 minutes ago or so. So hopefully you've gotten those in on time. And so this assignment builds upon the last one in that it's a little bit less introductory and we're getting into a bit more of the more interesting material now. So whereas before it was really like, say hello, introduce yourself, show us what your photographs are. Now it's more like, okay, here's the stuff that we're really getting into, and so welcome to Computer Science E7. So it's saying that to you in very much a, in a way that you will hopefully appreciate very soon. It's not to say that this assignment, of course, is impossible or even all that difficult. It's just that paying attention to the material that we go over in lectures will help you certainly get through, especially the first part, which is somewhat theory-based and will help you appreciate some of these technical aspects that we've been putting so much emphasis on throughout the semester. And so this assignment has three parts. The first part is a problem set-like portion, which, as I said, is somewhat theoretical in that it has some questions that are maybe a little bit math-like, or at least going over some of the more theory that we've been talking about the last few lectures, and we'll continue talking about in the upcoming lectures. Then part two asks you to take 10 photos, and realize that we don't expect you to take 10 photos. We expect you to take many, many photos and pick 10 from those photos that you take, and they should be, you know, very good photographs. And there's a number of requirements that you must meet in order to receive full credit on those photos. Yes.
Are you allowed to edit any of your photos?
I'm sorry.
Are you allowed to edit any of your photos?
No, not yet. No editing of any photos, please. So just pretty much when you take a photo, that's how we want it. It's sort of the raw photo, not a raw file. That is not something in a raw format that came out of your camera, but sort of the raw photo that you just took and uploaded to Flickr. You can, if you need to, resize the image so that you can meet any Flickr upload requirements or anything like that, but just keep in mind that you should maintain that metadata. Remember in the software lecture we talked about how all of these files have additional pieces of information embedded within them that tells us some information about how the photograph was taken, when it was taken, so on and so forth. You want to be sure that that data is preserved. Image editors like Photoshop and even some, and definitely some free ones, can maintain that metadata, but if you have any questions on that, do feel free to email us. And then part three is actually a continuation of part two, where maybe you're getting stuck on some particular image in part two and you want to get some feedback on it. That's the entire point of the third part of this assignment. You will upload one photo that you're having trouble with to your Flickr account, add it to a thread in the discussion board. You'll create your own thread and basically just ask people, what do you think? What could be improved? Or even ask a specific question and say, I'm having trouble with the lighting in this particular situation, or I can't quite get all of these objects in focus that I want to, or something like that. You could ask for some tips and tricks to try to help get you through that portion of the part. And so if you have any questions on this assignment, of course, you can feel free to send us an email. So recently, we've been going over a lot of the exposure values that are dealing with your camera. So we've talked about pretty much the four major components that determine the exposure on your camera. And so I've given you the answer here for one of them, but what are the other three, if you remember? So shutter speed is one. We also have aperture, yep, or F number. And the third one is, yep, and there's even a fourth one that's sort of sneaky that you can't actually control on your camera per se, but that would be, yeah, the amount of available light. That is perhaps the biggest dictator of what all of these various settings can actually be set to. And so as we talked about, all of these things come in versions of stops. So one stop difference is basically having or doubling the amount of available light that you have when exposing a particular image. But realize that cameras don't usually operate strictly in one stop increments. Sometimes they'll operate in half stop or even third stop increments. So for example, let's say we were working with the shutter speed of one, well, this is a very good example because it says 1/1250th of a second, and that's about a third of a way from the next lower shutter speed, which would be 1/1000th of a second, and it goes on from there. So whereas before we were talking about stop increments in terms of, okay, well, 1/500th of a second is one stop away from 1/1000th of a second, realize that many cameras have additional increments in the middle there. So you might also have something like 1/700th and 1/850th or something like that, additional, so two additional increments within the stop. And so, of course, those aren't additional stops that you're getting for free. It's just additional level of control or finer grained control over the exposure values that you have. And so it may seem a little bit crazy to have that sort of that fine level of control where you can take a photo with a difference of 250,000th of a second or something like that. But it really does become important when you are factoring in all of these other different types of exposure values into your image. And if you remember, we used shutter speed to try to freeze motion so that we could get either an action shot for, say, sports, or we could have a longer exposure time to introduce motion blur into the image. So if we wanted to get a little bit of artistic blur, then we could do it with a long shutter speed. And all this time I've been touting the use of a tripod to stabilize your camera to make sure that when you are using a very long shutter speed, it remains absolutely still so that you can have the shutter open for a second or 2 seconds or minutes or hours, and still it will remain relatively still so that only the objects that are moving within the image will appear to have motion blur. And there is actually an additional feature that some cameras, or rather some SLR cameras have, that can help you control motion blur a little bit more. And so if you flip through your SLR's manual, you may find this reference to a mirror lockup, or an MLU is as it's sometimes abbreviated. And if you remember from the way that SLRs work, and this is really only applicable to SLRs because compact digital cameras, as you'll understand in a moment, don't actually have this problem. But in SLRs, what happens when you take a photo is that there is the mirror inside, of course, that flips up and out of the way for the shutter to actually open and expose the sensor behind it. Now, this mirror has, non-zero mass. That is, it has some amount of weight to it. And so when it moves up and it hits the pentaprism up top, so there's actually a box that it hits at the top that keeps it from moving anymore, that can actually cause very, very slight vibrations in your camera that you would never actually notice or perceive individually. But at certain shutter speeds, even if it's on a tripod, you will notice a certain amount of motion blur within your images. And that's because this could drive you crazy. And in fact, if you're new to SLRs and you've used compact digital cameras even on tripods and have gotten very pristine, very crisp images without needing to use this feature, it could be a bit of a surprise when you use an SLR for the first time and realize that this thing happens. And so the mirror lockup, the whole point of this feature is that it moves the mirror up and out of the way before or some significant amount of time before you actually take the photo. And on Canons, it's unfortunately difficult to enable. But once you go into the menus and enable it, then let's say I take a photo. You notice that the mirror has moved up, but if you're actually able to look inside, you'll notice that the shutter is still closed. So I push the button once, that moves the mirror up and out of the way. Now all those vibrations will sort of soften and dampen over time. And now that those vibrations have gone, I can push the shutter button a second time, and it will actually move the shutter up and take the photo. And then, of course, at the end, it will move the mirror back down. So you can imagine that there's some other reasons why you could get some shakiness or some motion blur into your SLR camera. What I just did, for example, by holding the camera and actually pushing down on the button, that again is putting very minute vibrations into the camera, into this whole system. So even if you use mirror lockup and you're using the shutter button, unless you're very careful, you can introduce some additional vibrations and get a little bit of blurriness in the photo that way. And that's when you realize that, okay, you're gonna have to spend a little bit more money and get a remote unless your camera happens to come with one. But these are all sort of advanced things that you don't really need to, of course, to take a photo at all, but to get the absolute best photo that you can, you may realize that these are some techniques or some pieces of equipment that you will actually need to use. So going back to exposure values, we said shutter speed was one of them. The next one was ISO, so we could modify we can think of it as modifying the sensitivity of the sensor. And so if you remember from the film days, we had high ISO film to use it indoors. We had low ISO film to use it outdoors or in bright in bright conditions, and digital cameras, whether they're SLRs or compact cameras, also have this same notion where you can increase or change the sensitivity. And by increasing the sensitivity, you could get back an increase in shutter speed. So you could get a little bit of graininess in your image at the cost of being able to freeze motion a little bit better, or vice versa. If you wanted to introduce a little bit more motion blur, you could potentially get a cleaner image. Because as you remember, the downside to increasing the ISO in pretty much any camera is that you get additional levels of noise or splotchiness, and it depends on how your camera reacts to high ISO images. Sometimes you'll just see little speckles of different colored pixels, whether it be red or blue or an increase in brightness or a decrease in brightness. But sometimes they're very aggressive in their noise canceling characteristics, and you'll see that they try to smoothen it out a little bit by averaging some of the nearby pixels, and you'll get this sort of splotchiness that exists. Now the last one is aperture, or the F number. And so this was sort of the most difficult of the numbers to comprehend, because unlike sensitivity and shutter speed, where we could very easily double them or halve them in order to figure out what a stop difference was, increasing the aperture by one stop involved some complicated math, where we had to double the area of the lens, which means that, you know, we had to square root the diameter, and square root that in the end, and variety of other things that gave us some confusing numbers. But if you remember, the easy way to remember how to memorize these F numbers is to remember two numbers, F1 and F1.4, and alternatively double them each. So 2 and 2.8, 4, 5.6, so on and so forth, and you'll be able to remember them. Higher numbers mean that it is darker. It is a darker stop. Okay, so hopefully now all of you understand what these three values do, or how they impact your image and how they can make or break your photograph, depending on what you want to achieve within it. But most of you, I'm sure, have been using cameras up until now in some sort of an automatic mode, whether it defined one of these exposure values for you or even all three of them for you. It may not be so clear how the camera was able to determine this. And so know your slide or my projector or your computer screen at home is not broken. This is intentionally a gray screen. And this is how we can think of a camera is metering a scene. So this is just meant to be a very overgeneralized version of how a camera is able to figure out what the three exposure values should be. So it just looks at the scene and it tries to determine the level of brightness. And so it tries to make that level of brightness of the scene overall a sort of middle gray, this sort of mid-gray, sort of not too dark, not too bright. It's just sort of right in the middle. And the camera will try to adjust the exposure values so that overall the exposure will be for this middle gray. And so if it looks at a scene overall and it has a little metering sensor inside of it that tries to figure this information out, and it says, okay, it looks a little dark to me, what could it do? So let's say it just has some, so let's say that it's set by default to the Sunny 16 rule, which is what? So we're going to go off on a slight tangent here. Sunny 16 rule says what? Yep, ISO 100. 1/100
of a second.
1/100th of a second. At F16. And but what do those settings, how are they relevant? Yeah, bright sunny day outside. Okay, so let's say that the camera by default is looking at a scene at those particular settings and it thinks that the scene is a little bit dark. So what could the camera do to try to brighten the scene up? I'm sorry?
It could open up the aperture.
Right, it could open up the aperture. It could make the F number smaller, so it could go down to F11 or F8 or F5.6. What else could it do?
Increase the ISO.
So 100 is a little low. Maybe it could go up to 200, 400, 800, depending on the capabilities of the camera. Last one. Decrease the shutter speed. So rather than being 1/100th of a second, it could be 1/50th of a second. And now all of these things the camera takes into account, along with some other parameters that we'll talk about in a moment, to try to figure out exactly what settings it should use when trying to figure out metering. Now, there's actually a difference between incident light and reflected light. So incident light would be something like you're trying to take a picture directly of a light bulb, where that light bulb is glowing and it's a source of light, versus reflected light, which could be something like how you're seeing me right now. All of the light from the room is reflecting off of my clothing and off of my face, and you're seeing the photons that are being reflected. And so the camera doesn't understand the difference between each of this light. And so sometimes there are professional light meters where you may have seen them in especially in stock photos of, or even behind the scenes videos of movies, for example, where they show these photographers holding this silly looking device in their hand that has a white bulb at the end. You might have seen this and not really understood what it was for, but what it's doing is measuring the incident light, so the amount of light that is within the room and not being reflected off of the person. And then this way, they could either have it memorized or look up in some tables, try to figure out exactly what exposure settings they should use based on the amount of light in the room. Now, arguably, this gives you the best exposure settings to use, because then you can take into account a variety of things. So, for example, if I was wearing a black shirt instead of a red shirt, then you can imagine that this might fool the camera, because if you're taking a picture of primarily my shirt, for example, or a portrait of me, and the shirt is taking up the majority of the photo, the camera might say, okay, well, this looks very dark, so I'll try to make it a little bit brighter. And so this happens because it's recording the reflected light rather than the incident light. And if I had some way of knowing this incident light, or the amount of light that was in the room, then I could very accurately give the camera the proper exposure settings for that room, for pretty much everything in that room and all of the photos that you take, assuming the light doesn't change, will be accurate. And so you'll realize that there's, even though the incident light is the most accurate way of recording exposure or taking or figuring out exposure values, the cameras that we use just do not have that sort of luxury to do that. And unless you want to spend a lot of money purchasing one of these pieces of hardware, it's going to be difficult for you to do the same. And so instead, we have to go through a number of tricks to try to use the reflected light instead to meter our photos. And so there's a variety of metering modes that your camera has to try to combat these various problems that exist. So just in this one example that I mentioned, I'm wearing a black shirt and you're taking a portrait of me that's primarily of my shirt. Maybe it's of my upper body, for example. And so the camera then sees, you know, most of the image is black, is very, very dark, and it will try to increase the exposure values to bring it up to this sort of middle gray. You can imagine that would be a bad thing, because you could overexpose my face. So we have a couple of metering modes that we can use to try to combat this. So one of them, for example, is the spot metering mode. And so some cameras, I'm going to go through a variety of these metering modes, and you should realize that many cameras do support all of these, but some cameras only support some of them, if that makes sense. So whatever you see here, you'll have to look into your camera's manual to see if it actually supports these various metering modes. So here, this is basically a graph, and you can imagine that we have along this x and y axis of this graph here is that image that you're trying to take a picture of. So it's just the image that you're taking a picture of sort of angled, and the height of the graph is telling you the importance that the camera is placing within certain regions of the photograph for metering. So in other words, you can see that all of this, the surrounding area here is very, very low. That means that the camera is not going to look at it when determining what exposure should be middle gray, and instead it's only going to be taking the very center spot, hence the name, spot metering, the very center spot when trying to consider exposure settings. So in other words, if you now changed your metering mode to spot metering, and I held up just a gray card, a card that was meant to show you, you know, exactly what's called 18% gray, and some people call it 12% gray, and there's some debate about this, but basically it's called an 18% gray card that's basically this middle gray. If I held this up and you pointed the camera, the center of the viewfinder, at that gray card, and then told the camera to remember those exposure values, then you have basically used spot metering to try to combat this reflected light problem that we have. So by looking at the very center of the image, so if you just, you know, pointed it at that gray card, recorded the exposure values, and your camera can do that for you, then you will be able to take a properly exposed photograph without this problem of the camera making the rest of the image too bright because I was wearing a very, very dark shirt. Now, generally, a spot mode is meant to be a very small portion of the image. It's about the center 3% or so of this. And if you are if you're going to use this trick that I mentioned where you are remembering the exposure values, you'll have to look for something called an AE lock or an auto exposure lock on your camera. Some cameras have a dedicated button for it. Other cameras, you have to make a button dedicated for it. But you just point it at it, push the AE lock button. That means the exposure settings are locked for that particular scene. Then the scene can move around, and when you take the photo, it takes the photo at those particular exposure settings. Now, there's a different one as well, which might have been popular pretty early on, and that was this center-weighted metering mode. So rather than spot, which uses a very small percentage right in the middle of the image to try to figure out the proper exposure settings, center-weighted still uses the center primarily in its calculation of the proper exposure values, but it also smoothly falls off towards the edges. So this might work a little bit better if you were just taking a picture of me in my black shirt. It might work a little bit better if you had composed it so that my face was, maybe in the top third or so of this image, because then you might see that the camera would realize that there's some brighter portions in this image and may not try to increase the exposure values so much. But there is a problem with this, as you can imagine, and that is that, in the very first lecture I told you to stop centering everything in the middle of the frame. And so if you listen to me, then you'll realize that this is not actually going to help you out very much, because then you'll still have to use spot metering and meter on something that's off to the side and then recompose, with an AE lock. So this is not really going to be all that helpful. So one of the most recent and I use recent in relative terms. One of the most recent innovations in this, and what many, many cameras use, is zone metering. And zone metering can get really complicated really quickly. There's some cameras can have up to 1,000 zones. It'll break up the image into 1,000 different zones and meter each one independently. And every manufacturer has a different way of using zone metering to calculate the exposure values. But let's say that we took this image and broke it into 9 zones. So we have a zone here, a zone here, a zone here. Now what the camera can do is use a variety of information that's given to it to try to figure out how it can meter this scene. So for example, let's say that I had focused on this guy sitting over here. Well, the camera could say, okay, I'm focusing in on this zone over here, so I should place more importance on the exposure of that zone because that's where the subject is, for example. So this is just one way they could do it. So you could use they could use the AF point, the autofocus point like I just described. It could also try to use the distance to the subject to figure out how much importance to give it. So if the subject is very, very far away, then maybe we have to give a few more zones some importance when it's trying to calculate the exposure. And then, let's see, so it could try to also figure out based on the aperture, or the F number rather, what portions of the image are in and out of focus, and then it could maybe ignore those zones, for example. And then, let's see, so it could also try to figure out, if something is backlit, if there's some regions, if it knows what the subject is, for example, and it knows that it's very, very bright behind the subject, then it could try to figure out to ignore those things. So on and so forth. But as you can see, this is getting to be a very, very complicated algorithm. And no camera manufacturer has it absolutely perfect. And so you will still have a variety of problems that exist through some difficult situations. And you will have to adjust or change your exposure values depending on that particular situation. But anyway, if your camera has its own metering mode, this is most likely what you will be using because it will generally be the most accurate in general situations, unless you have something very specific in mind, like you're in a studio, for example, with fixed lighting, then you might want to use spot metering, figure out the exact exposure for that particular setting and remember those values or use the auto exposure lock so that those settings do not actually change. Center weighted, this is just meant as you can use it, but I don't think it's going to be terribly, terribly useful. But also, when we're talking about zone metering, You shouldn't really use the number of zones. You shouldn't really take that into account when deciding to purchase one camera over another. I would argue that metering has gotten pretty good at this point. And no matter what camera you buy, it's going to have some downfalls and it's going to have some advantages over other cameras. And so you'll have to learn your camera and try to figure out how it's going to react. So you're saying, well, it sounds like there's a lot of information that could be used in zone metering, so why isn't it perfect? So there are actually several examples of when this can actually fail. So snow, for example. Snow will almost always trick a camera, a camera's metering system, and you'll have some problems there. If something is backlit, or sunrises, sunsets, if any very heavy change between light and dark regions of a scene, you will probably have some problems with. Dark jackets, dark objects, objects with lots of shadows will tend to give metering problems, and you'll have to try to combat this. And in fact, a scene like this, where you have not only white snow, but also people wearing dark jackets, it can actually be double trouble. It could actually be very difficult to try to get everything properly exposed. So if you remember, if you have a situation like this, you could use bracketing, for example, but that's sort of silly in this case, where obviously things and people are in motion and it's going to be difficult. But to make this even more concrete, so what is actually happening when metering fails, let's say you take a picture of a scene that's primarily snow. And so if you take a look on the left side, this is without any exposure compensation. And so there's this concept of exposure compensation where you can tell the camera, okay, I think you're going to be wrong about exposing this scene, so I'm going to tell you to change your exposure values, either some number of stops brighter or some number of stops darker. And so if you take a photo that looks like this, then you might realize, okay, I have to actually adjust the exposure compensation on this camera to properly expose the image within it. And so if you notice, this actually looks very, very gray, very, very similar to what I described before of the camera trying to make the whole scene sort of this middle of the road gray, because that's what happens in most situations. However, for snow, for photos of snow areas, that's going to be pretty much incorrect. And we need to dial in some additional or some positive exposure compensation in order to tell it that the scene is actually much brighter than the camera thinks it is. So if you take a scene that looks like this, and actually if you take a photo of a scene and you look at it on the LCD screen of your camera, it may actually be somewhat difficult to tell if this is under or overexposed. So you might actually have to use a quantitative tool that can help you figure it out, and that's called the histogram. We'll go into a lot of detail about that in a couple of lectures, but just realize that there is a way, even if you're outside and looking on this little tiny screen on your camera, there is a way for you to tell if the exposure is incorrect or not correct, or is incorrect or correct. And so if you look at the histogram, you might realize, okay, this actually looks some number of stops too dark. So you might actually, and this is where experience really comes into play, because you might say, okay, well, this looks one stop darker, and so you try to increase the stops by one. So if we take a look at the exposure values that the camera decided to use, on the left, we have a photo that was taken at 1/80th of a second, at ISO 400 and an F number of 2.8. There was no exposure compensation at the time, so that was just the exposure values that the camera decided to use. But on the right, I said, okay, well, there's a lot of snow in this picture, so I need to increase the exposure compensation by about 1.3 stops, so about 1 1/3. So now what the camera did was that it used 1/80th of a second at ISO 800, so I got one additional stop there, and at an F number of 2.5. So I gained that 1.3 additional stops by making the aperture 1/3 of a stop larger and by increasing the sensitivity by about one stop. So if you really need to keep, remember, this is where all of your knowledge now of exposure values can come into play. If you're in a certain metering, or if you're in a certain exposure mode, and you need to keep some value constant. So for example, shutter speed, you can modify those other two values, or you can have the camera modify the other two values to try to do this. Now, exposure compensation is usually used for modes where the camera is trying to figure out either one or more of the exposure values for you, because that's where it makes sense, is that if it's trying to calculate some number of values for you and you know that it's going to be wrong, then you can use exposure compensation to try to force an overexposure. However, the same thing can happen other times if you have a scene that's way too bright. So maybe somebody, so in that previous example that I mentioned where I'm wearing a very dark shirt and it's going to try to make the scene a little bit too bright, you can decrease the exposure compensation or you can put negative exposure compensation in to try to tell it to be darker. And so sometimes your camera will show you like a little graph with a little bar underneath of how much exposure compensation you're putting in. Just realize that if you're putting in, and this was confusing for me at first too, so don't worry if it is for you as well. But if you dial in a positive amount, that means you want the camera to make the scene brighter. So you're telling the camera to be brighter by putting in a positive amount of exposure compensation. And you're telling the camera, conversely, to be darker to take the scene maybe at a faster shutter speed, for example, by putting in negative exposure compensation. Now, all of these these sorts of capabilities of the camera, using the zone metering and all of this stuff, we said that there is a variety of ways that the camera could modify, let's say, the Sunny 16 rule in order to figure out what values it should actually be using. But it can actually, but as you saw, we have three values that we can modify. So if we have the Sunny 16 rule, we suddenly take a picture inside and we know it's too dark, how does the camera know which of those three values to modify? And that is what some of these metering modes try to do for you. So you know, a lot of cameras have a variety of modes in addition to sort of an auto mode where it does everything for you. And you can see that there's a bunch there that the camera will try to use. So going counterclockwise from here, we have a portrait mode, for example. We have landscape mode, sports mode, close-up or a macro mode, or a night portrait mode. And some newer cameras have even more of these useless modes, like self-portrait, party, candlelight. And I'm just listing some of the ones that comes from that camera that you can rent from 53 Church Street. I'm just using it as an example for what companies shouldn't do, I think. So that you can also have self-portrait mode, party mode, candlelight mode, sunset mode, fireworks mode, beach mode, snow mode. Like, come on, really? Do we really need all of that stuff? Well, if we look at all of these logically, you'll realize that all of these things are very easily replicated by yourself, just using one of these manual modes. And by doing so, you have a lot more control over the camera. So let's take a look at portrait mode, for example. So in a portrait, what do you generally want? So when you've seen a professional level portraits, it's a photo of a person and that's it, right? They try to isolate the person or the subject from everything else. So you might then want to have a lot of background blur to try to isolate the subject of the person away from the background, especially if it's a busy street or somewhere that's, you know, not exactly a studio. So with this in mind, let's say that we have it set to portrait mode here. So what might the camera try to do when taking a photo in portrait mode? Right, exactly. So based on how bright it thinks the scene is, it will open up the aperture as much as it can, so it'll make the F number be as low as it possibly can, and then it will adjust the other two values as necessary. So then if it's a very wide open aperture, it's letting in a lot of light, and that means you can get a fast shutter speed. That's generally a good thing. Now, landscape mode might be the opposite. You might have a lot in the scene that you want to get into focus. So you might have what then for this? Yes?
Smaller.
Yeah, so a small aperture or a large F number, you will get then a lot or a large depth of field, and you'll try to get as much into the scene as possible. So what I'm referring to here is how the camera might bias one or more of these settings when trying to calculate the final exposure values that it can. So it might use a relatively high F number, like F11 or F16, if it's possible to use, when in landscape mode. So how about sports? Yeah, the highest shutter speed it possibly can. So it's going to make that as high as it possibly can, maybe increase the ISO a little bit, maybe open the aperture as much as it possibly can there as well. So close up, that may be difficult to visualize, but when you're taking macro photos, the depth of field actually becomes much, much, much narrower than you are used to. So it will then, it might be very similar to landscape mode, where it would try to make the depth of field large by increasing the F number, for example. Night portrait, this one could be a little bit tough. It might try to use flash, for example. It might have to use very long shutter speed to try to get some objects in to actually become exposed in a photo, and it really depends on that one, I think, on what you're talking about, whether it's a night mode or a night portrait mode, on how it would react in those cases. And so those are just sort of the more popular ones. And so now that you are getting a grasp of these things, hopefully now you can stop relying on these modes quite so much. And in fact, cameras, as cameras get more expensive, you'll notice that they actually have fewer metering modes. So this is the metering dial from a now ancient 5D, Canon 5D, and they don't have any of these other modes. They don't have portrait mode, they don't have landscape mode, etc. They assume that the person that is purchasing this camera knows how to use these sort of more manual modes to try to take a photo with the particular effects that they want to use. So there's a couple of things that's interesting about this. First of all, they have a green box, which is sort of a completely automatic mode, which is still useful if, for example, you are on vacation and you trust someone enough to take a photo of you in front of a particular location, then it might be useful to set your camera to that sort of automatic mode for them. But going counterclockwise from there, you'll see that we have some other manual modes as well. So we have a P mode, what's called a program mode. What this will do is it basically allows you to set the ISO to whatever ISO you want, and then it will try to calculate aperture and shutter speed for you. So and you can usually adjust one of the dials behind your camera to either increase the shutter speed and decrease the F number at the same time, or do the converse depending on what you want. Some people prefer this mode, but I think what are some of the more useful modes, at least for myself, are the next two. So TV, or shutter priority, and AV, or aperture priority. And in these modes, what you get to do are set the ISO and the shutter speed or the aperture, respectively, and then the camera will figure out the rest. So for TV mode, so shutter speed priority, for example, you might say, okay, well, I have to take a photo that's, you know, reasonably fast. So I'm in a sports situation. I need to take a reasonably fast photo. So I'll set a relatively high shutter speed with the shutter speed priority mode. I'll set maybe a relatively high ISO as well, so that I can get a pretty decent aperture, and then it will automatically calculate the aperture or the F number for you. So aperture priority mode does basically the same thing, but for the aperture, you get to set the F number that you want to use. So you could say, okay, I want a lot of depth of field, I want a little bit of depth of field, and then you set the ISO, and then it calculates the shutter speed that it can use for you. And for what it's worth, of all of these modes, I tend to use the aperture priority the most. And the reason for that, even though the shutter speed priority might actually sound somewhat useful, it's that the actual range of the F number is somewhat low compared to the range of shutter speed. So your lens might be capable of, say, f2.8 to about f11, and that's just not that many stops when compared to the wide range of shutter speeds that's available. So it's generally, you generally have to do a little bit less futzing with the camera if you are using the aperture priority mode. Then, of course, the M is the fully manual mode. You get to set all three of these exposure values by yourself. Sometimes your camera will give you a little bit of a graph that will try to help you figure out if it thinks you are properly or improperly exposing your scene. And in fact, I highly recommend that if you are not familiar with a lot of these exposure values, that you take a number of photos in the manual mode. It will really give you a new appreciation for all of the technology behind a camera. The B, in this case, is a bulb mode. So if you remember, I mentioned that if you hold, there's a certain mode that if you hold down the shutter button, it will keep the shutter open for that long, for however long you hold it. That is the bulb mode. And in this case, there's a dedicated metering mode for it. Sometimes you have to go into the menus or into the manual mode and adjust some settings to get that yourself. But that will also be really, really useful in particularly dark areas. And this last one, this C mode, that's probably just a custom mode that's available through the menus of this particular camera. All right, so we've talked about the three major ways that you can adjust the settings on the camera to affect the outcome of your photo. So we talked about the shutter speed, the sensitivity, and the aperture. But one of the things we haven't really talked about is changing the amount of available light that exists within a scene. So maybe the scene is a little bit dark and you need to increase some light. Or maybe the scene is a little bit too bright and you need to try to decrease the amount of light there. And so for this last example, remember that I mentioned you could use like a large reflector or even a large poster board or a large sheet of paper, just something to try to block out light if you have a small area. But where it can become problematic is if you're taking a picture of a large scene, so maybe a large landscape, for example. I bet you don't have a sheet of paper that's large enough to cover an entire mountaintop, for example. Now, I'm a big fan of taking photos in natural light because I think there's something very organic and very neat about the way that those photos look, particularly indoors. It's not something that you see very frequently, except maybe more recently as cameras get a little bit better with their sensitivity and can have higher ISOs with not such ridiculous noise. But even just a couple of years ago, and still to this day, it's really hard to find good photos of natural light that are taken indoors because it's very limiting. There's not a lot of light available to you. To go off on a very small tangent, for years I had this stigma against using flash, so against using additional levels of light, because it seemed very difficult at the time to get it to look natural, to get it to look like it belonged in the photo and didn't look like a very typical flash photo where you see the person's face that's completely blown out with exposure and then everything behind them is completely dark because the flash can't reach. And there's also a variety of reasons why you might want to use natural light rather than using flash. And so, for example, sports. If you are in an indoor sports arena, for example, and you're trying to take photos of a team or of a sporting event that's happening indoors, using a flash can be distracting for the players. It can be difficult for them to concentrate, particularly if the flash is near the near where they are playing. So you might not always have this sort of luxury available to you. But as you can tell, one of the things that is important to us as photographers is being able to enhance the amount of available light and to use a flash in order to get more light in the scene. So this image here is a very typical example of a flash unit that's built into a camera. So you could have a Nikon or a Canon camera that has a flash that basically just pops up and it lets you use and basically will take a flash photo for you. And so these units are they're okay. They're decently powered, but they're not going to do a whole lot of favors. There's a number of things that's working against you and reasons why you perhaps should not be using the flash that's available here. But on the converse side, of course, there's a number of good reasons why you would want to. So if I were to take a photo and if I took that photo with flash, what's sort of the typical scenario? How does that photo typically look in terms of the exposure?
Even but flat.
So portions of the image, the portions where the flash properly exposes, those look properly exposed, but they're also very flat. The lighting is somewhat flat, but it is also somewhat harsh at the same time. But very shortly before that subject, so if the subject was here and there properly exposed, very shortly before that subject and very shortly after that subject, you get exposure problems. So behind the subject, it's going to be too dark. It's going to definitely be overexposed, or rather underexposed. And before the subject, if you have any objects within the photo, it's going to be overexposed. And so this is something that we as photographers have to battle with when we are talking about using a flash. And in fact, I don't mean to scare you with a little bit of math, but the reason that this happens is for this property called the inverse square law. So if we have some source of light, so whether it be the sun, a flash unit, a flashlight, it doesn't really matter what it is. Let's say that it's just here in the center, S, or right here. So these two are basically the same thing. Now, that light, as you know, just emanates everywhere. So it expands in every possible direction through space. And so what this means is that as you get farther and farther away from the thing that is producing light, you are getting fewer photons, because as you're getting farther away from it, those photons are splitting farther and farther apart, and so your eyes are only going to see a certain amount of photons. And so to talk about this in more scientifically or more rigidly, we have this inverse square law. So every time you double the distance away, so let's say that right now I am, you know, about a meter, about 3 feet away from the flash unit, but now let's say that I go back another meter, I've now doubled my distance, I now am getting 1/4 the amount of light. So I'm, by doubling my distance, I get 1/4 the amount of light. And so that's where this inverse square law comes into play. Every time you double it, you are getting 1/4 the amount of light. Or every time you triple it, you have to square the number here. So every time you triple it, you are getting 1/9 the amount of light that was available, you know, at the source. So very, very quickly, you are getting much, much less light that was emanating from the source available to you for any reason. So whether you are using it to view or whether you're using it to take a photograph of, every time you double the distance, you're getting much, much less light. You're getting 2 stops less light every time you double the distance, to make it more concrete. And so that's a lot less light that you have to deal with. And as we've been talking about, cameras are very, very sensitive to the range that they can detect, the range of photons that they can detect. There's a certain amount of photons that's definitely too little, and there's a certain amount of photons that's definitely too much. And if it's more than that, it's going to appear overexposed, it's going to appear all white. If it's less than that range, it's going to appear too dark. And because of this inverse square law, that's precisely what's happening with these flash photos. So if you're a certain distance away and I'm properly exposed here, you can imagine that very quickly before and very quickly after me, in terms of the distance from the camera, am I going to have too much or too little light available to properly expose an object. So to come back to these diagrams here, if we imagine that this source is giving out, just to make this hopefully a little bit more concrete, if we imagine that this source is giving out exactly 4 photons of light, which isn't a lot, but it's just to give you an idea so you can use these lines as sort of a guide. Now, if I am a certain distance away, and let's say that my eye is maybe that large, for example, now I can see those 4 photons. But as I get farther away, those photons are splitting farther and farther, because as they emanate from the source, they're getting farther and farther apart. So that means that I need to have a larger area in order to detect those same 4 photons. And in fact, you notice that now my eye only gets 1 of those photons, whereas before it got all 4. And the same thing just sort of happens as you propagate farther and farther away. So as a distance, and what they're calling the distances R here, as the distance R increases, the intensity of the light decreases by R squared, and that's divided by R squared. So that's all the inverse square law says, is that by increasing the distance, you are decreasing the intensity of that light by that distance squared. And so this is a big problem for us in terms of flashes. And so there is yet another equation that I have to introduce to you that a lot of flash manufacturers use to try to tell you how powerful their flashes are. So if you can imagine that there is a particular range, so let's say this flash is powerful enough to properly illuminate something all the way to maybe 3 feet away, for example. So even though it's dispersing a lot, something 3 feet away can still be properly exposed. There is a way that these flash manufacturers try to tell you how powerful they are. And that is using something called the guide number. And so the guide number is a number that's usually on flash marketing materials or even on a review for flashes, for example. And all it really means is the guide number is equal to the distance times the F number. Now, this may not make a lot of sense, but in order for it to make a bit of sense, we have to realize something about flashes. So when you take a flash picture, it happens very, very quickly, very, 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 very quickly. So it happens, we can see the flash, but it really happens faster than we would be able to react to it. It's maybe thousandths of a second long that this flash is releasing this amount of light. And if you remember, we have this shutter that moves over the focal plane. And if you remember those high-speed videos of the shutter, what we saw in almost all of the cases was that there's basically two curtains to the shutter. They're called curtains. And as one curtain was going up, the other curtain is following it shortly behind. This introduces this problem where at any one moment in time, only a small portion of the actual sensor is exposed. So if you are taking a flash photo and your flash fires at the exact moment that this particular portion of the sensor is exposed sort of to light, then the end result of that photo is that you're only going to see this little sliver properly exposed, and nothing else is going to be properly exposed within that image, because the flash lasted for an instant, just this tiny instant that the shutter was open, and all the rest of that shutter was blocked for that particular shutter speed. Now, there is actually a certain speed at which the shutter is open completely, and this is the speed that we can take flash photos, because any faster than that, we are going to have this problem right here where a portion of the sensor is masked by the shutter, so we are not actually going to properly expose all of the frame because it is being blocked. But there is a certain speed where one curtain opens completely, exposing the shutter, and a brief amount of time exists when the other curtain will close in front of it. So let's see, just to make this hopefully a little bit more concrete, I just want to show you those really cool videos from before, and hopefully I still have them here. Let's see, all right. Here's a good one. We'll look at this one. This is a film-based camera, a Canon Elan, but that's okay. It still is the same sort of idea. So here you'll see that when the shutter button is pressed, you're going to see one shutter curtain moving down and the other shutter curtain is moving up, or rather the other shutter curtain is following it very, very quickly thereafter. So I'm just going to go through it frame by frame. You can see here we have two curtains, this one down here, this one up here, and only this small sliver of the scene is actually exposed to the sensor. So if you take a flash photo and the flash fires right here, all you're going to see is that particular portion of the image that is properly exposed. Everything else is going to be black because it did not properly expose that particular part of the image. So what we need then, again, just as a reminder, is that this first curtain that falls, it must open all the way. It must open completely. Then there must be a little bit of time for the flash to fire while both curtains are completely open. Then the other curtain can follow and shut behind it. And this is called the sync speed of the camera. And this is relevant to SLRs, because SLRs have physical shutters that actually move, as you've just seen a second ago. And many compact cameras don't actually have this restriction because they use electronic shutters. They just use electronic timing, basically, to figure out, okay, I should take a picture at this exact moment, and the entire frame is still visible. So you usually don't have this sort of problem that exists in compact flashes as well. But keeping this in mind, that there's a maximum speed, and for many cameras, it's about 1/250th of a second, or sometimes as fast as 1/500th of a second, where once you set the camera to that speed, the first curtain will open completely, so completely exposing the sensor, and then the second curtain will follow behind it. That's the maximum shutter speed that you can take a flash photo without improperly exposing it. Okay, now with that in mind, we can look at this guide number and hopefully it will make a little bit more sense, because when we look at this guide number, you realize that there's no indication of shutter speed within it, because it's assuming that shutter speed doesn't really matter in this case. When we're talking about flash, the flash fires a certain amount of light, and if that shutter is open completely to capture all of that light, it doesn't matter how fast or how slow the shutter is, it's still only getting that much light from the flash. So for that reason, shutter speed is not that important, so it's really the F number that is important for us when we are talking about the guide number. Yes? Okay, so very good question. So when we're talking about these manual modes that I referenced earlier, yeah, so if you use the manual mode, for example, what you will generally do when taking a flash photo is set it at the sync speed, so at 1/250th of a second. That's the value for my camera. Your camera might be different. It's usually 1/250th to 1/500th. You'll set it to that, and then you will change the ISO and the F number accordingly, because those two other values still have relevance. So if you increase the ISO, it's now a little bit more sensitive. So if you have a certain intensity of flash, you can increase the ISO and that flash will now reach a little bit farther. Or if you are using a flash at ISO 100 and you know that, let's say at F4, for example, it can illuminate up to maybe 10 feet away, and now hopefully you can see where this guide number is coming in. So at ISO 100 and at the sync speed, I can use F4 at a distance of about 10 feet away. Now I can actually lower the F number, for example, to maybe 2.8 and be able to get a little bit more reach that way because it's letting in more light that was available from the flash. Okay, but I know this stuff is really, really interesting, but let's take a quick 5-minute break. And when we come back, we'll keep talking about flash photography. Hello everyone, welcome back. So before the break we were talking about guide number and how luckily it's just, you know, multiplying two numbers so it doesn't look all that scary, but how there's a lot of information behind this number. So do feel free to stop me and ask me any questions that may come up about this stuff, but realize that all we are talking about at this point is that a couple of things are happening. Flashes, they fire the light that they have saved up in them very quickly, and the shutter actually takes a certain amount of time to travel over the sensor. And so for us to properly take a well-exposed flash photograph, we generally need to be using what's called the sync speed, or the X-sync speed, depending on the camera manufacturer, which just means that there is a specific moment in time at which both curtains of the shutter are completely open, exposing the entire sensor. So if we assume that for at least the next couple of minutes of discussion that we are taking photos at the X sync speed, it could even be slower. It doesn't really matter because you're not going to be getting any additional light from the flash if you have a slower shutter speed. Hopefully that makes sense, because if it's completely dark in this room, for example, I fire the flash, that's all the light you're going to get. It doesn't matter if you have your shutter open for hours, you're just not going to get any more light from this flash unless you fire it again. So for flash photography, most of the time, we can take a photo at the X sync speed. And this means that we can usually use the guide number as a rough estimate of how powerful this flash is, or how far we can expect the flash to reach an object and properly expose it at a certain ISO and at a certain F number, you know, at that sync speed. So taking the sync speed out of the equation, we now realize that the guide number tells us quite a bit about the power of the flash itself. So usually what you see is a guide number at a specific ISO, most of the time you see it, like you'll see a guide number of maybe 40, and it'll say at ISO 100 or something like that, and that's all it means is that, you know, at an ISO of 100, you can get a certain distance times a certain F number. So let's say we have this guide number of 40. So what we would then be able to do is figure out, okay, I'm taking a photograph at the sync speed at ISO 100. That means that I can properly expose a photograph at F4 about 10 feet away. So assuming that the guide number is in feet, then that is what it is telling us. Sometimes the guide number is in meters, and if you're not comfortable with meters, you'll have to do a reverse conversion. Sometimes they even provide both for you. But anyway, by using an F number of about 4 at ISO 100 and at the X-sync speed, you can properly expose a photograph at about 10 feet away. So let's say now that instead we change the F number two stops. Let's make it two stops brighter to F2. Remember, F2.8 is the intermediate stop between 2 and 4. So we are now using an F number of 2 at a guide number of 40 and ISO 100. How far can we take a flash photo? 20 feet. Yep, that's right. So 2 times 20 is 40. And so you can see that in order for us to double the reach of this flash, we actually have to let in 4 times as much light. Remember that inverse square law? So we had to go not one stop, but 2 stops away in F number in order to get double the distance allowed from the light. And that is because of this inverse square law. Yes? So the X-sync speed, we're sort of ignoring that because that is the maximum speed at which your camera can take a flash photo and properly expose the entire frame. If you take a flash photo any faster than that, you're going to get like a little band, a dark band, whose severity depends on how much over the sync speed you attempted to set the camera. So for most flash photographs, we're talking about taking photos at this X-sync speed. Okay, so now, let's say that we actually change this guide number to be talking about this same number at ISO 200. So now, even though we are twice as sensitive, we don't actually get as much, we don't get basically a doubling of that guide number. Because if you remember, you were doubling the distance from that camera, you are going to make the amount of the intensity of the light 1/4 of available to you. So if we just double the sensitivity, that's not enough for us to actually increase the guide number by, you know, 2. It's actually going to be very similar to this F number. It's actually going to go up in 1.4 increments. So if you did some math, you would realize that at ISO 200, the same guide number, whereas before it was at 10 feet at F4, we can now do only 14 feet at F4. Okay, so modern flashes, though, are very, very quick. They last from maybe 1/1000th to a second to even faster, to about 1/32000th of a second. And so this is really, really fast, and you can use them actually in addition to stop quite a bit of motion. And in fact, that's what one flash pioneer, Dr. Edgerton, who took some wonderful photos using high-speed flash photography, and what he actually did was not use a very, very, very fast shutter speed to try to get this photo, but he instead used a very fast burst of light. And so this may sound counterintuitive at first, but you can actually use a very long shutter speed to take a photo just like this. So if you have a completely dark room, for example, there's no light, you have a very long shutter speed so that the shutter is open and accepting light, but there's no light for it to record. When you fire a flash that's very, very quick, maybe 1/64000th or 1/32000th of a second, you can properly expose something that happens very, very quickly in time while using a long shutter speed. And in fact, that is what Dr. Edgerton did in order to get photos just like this. So, and I realize that it sounds somewhat counterintuitive, but if you think about it, you know, in terms of the amount of light that's available in the room, if you keep a very long shutter speed and there's no light available in the room, you're not going to see anything. You're not going to get any motion blur. You're not going to see anything until you fire the flash. Because when you fire the flash, that's when you get that short burst of light, and that's when you illuminate the object, you know, essentially freezing it in time, and you are able to capture it on your camera. And in fact, this sort of thing is very possible for you to do at home with camera equipment, even just like this, frankly. So just an SLR camera where you can have a somewhat long shutter speed, a room that you can make very, very dark, and an external flash that you can try to fire remotely. You can usually find, whether for free or maybe for just a couple of dollars, basically instructions where you can design a circuit that uses sound to try to fire a flash. So you can adjust this circuit so that it will either fire very shortly after the sound or a slight delay after that sound occurs, so that you can use that, for example, in a very dark room to pop a balloon. The circuit hears that sound and it fires the flash, and then you're able to capture the balloon popping on your camera. And so this is actually a really fun way of being able to capture very high speed effects that can occur very, very quickly, very, very fast, beyond even the shutter speed of your own camera. And in fact, you can use the same sort of technique for taking shots of lightning, for example. So lightning, particularly at night, it happens somewhat randomly, and you may look at a photo and say, how on earth did they time getting this photo with that piece of lightning, or with that, you know, that bolt of lightning that's occurring on the corner of the frame? And frankly, it's a bit of patience and it's a bit of luck. They were using a long exposure, like a bulb mode, for example, and they just waited for lightning to occur, because not much light is entering into their camera until that lightning bolt strikes. Then they can close the shutter and they can see that they have gotten that one lightning bolt within their particular image. But anyway, so going back to flash units, when we're talking about flashes, even consumer flashes that we can buy for relative inexpensiveness, so maybe a couple of $100, for example, to buy a pretty decent flash unit, you can adjust not only their intensity, but this also adjusts their speed as well, because they can fire a certain amount of light in, let's say, 1/1000th of a second, and if you have that time, then you are also having the intensity, because that is as much photons as it can give out. So you can think of it as almost being a shutter speed for the flash, for example, in that it can only give off a certain amount of photons in a certain amount of time. So if you expel as many photons as you possibly can in 1/1000th of a second, and you have that, so now you have 1/2000th of a second, it's now twice as fast, you're also having the number of photons that this one flash can put out. So you can keep going, and usually they have a wide range. And so I mentioned before that flash units can go from about 1/1000th of a second to about 1/32000th of a second. That's about 8 stops of light, because you go from 1/1000th to 2000, 4, 8, 16, okay, I guess 6 stops. But anyway, it's the point remains that you have some number of stops of difference, and the less intensity that you have this flash give out, then you can have it give quite a bit faster flash time and be able to freeze more motion. Now, this is all the stuff, you know, behind flash. And hopefully now, understanding this, you can try to avoid photos that looks like this. So whereas before, I was very embarrassed to show you that one photo where I had completely underexposed the bridge and completely overexposed the sky, now I have to further embarrass myself and show you a photo that I took of my siblings. Luckily, this was many years ago, 7 years ago. But this is a very difficult situation at the same time. So it's dark outside, and that's actually the moon. That's not the sun, by the way. So there's not a lot of light. And, you know, you're trying to take a flash photo, and you're trying to get everything into the photo. But this photo really tells me, or should really show you, all of the things that I think can be wrong with flash photography. So let us count the ways. Okay, first of all, my brother and sister look more like demons than they already are because of their red eyes. Then, of course, we have only they are properly exposed. You can see it's very quickly. The light fall off is very quick. We can't see any of the white sand that exists behind them, which is very beautiful. Then, of course, we have the harsh shadows that exist directly behind them. They're not as obvious, but it is just as obnoxious. And on top of all that, the flash didn't even do its job. We still have motion blur, not only within them, but also in the background itself. So there's a lot of stuff, you know, that's wrong with this particular photo. And to fix each of these things, there's different ways that we can fix each of these different problems that I just mentioned. So the red eye, for example, and many of you are probably familiar with why this happens, but we have the iris that light enters through, and if it's a big bright flash of light and our iris because we have adjusted to night vision, basically our eyes look very, very large, so all of the light is reflecting, going through the iris, reflecting off the back of the eye and just coming back out, and the back of our eye is actually red in color, and so that's why it looks red, you know, here, in that the flash is just reflecting directly off the back of the eye and it looks bad. It reflects off the retina and it looks bad and red. So is there a way that we can fix this? Well, many cameras have this really gimmicky red eye reduction feature. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It depends not only on the camera's red eye reduction feature, but also the person you're taking a photo of. Younger folks, so for example, my brother and sister, children especially, their eyes can react very, very quickly to light. So red eye reduction features might work on them. But as we age, our eyes react more slowly. So it could take longer for the iris to actually, for the aperture within our eye to actually contract and try to change the size of the iris that exists here in the eye. So using red eye reduction is really hit or miss, frankly. And so there must be another way that we can solve this. And one way is that if you realize that one of the reasons that we have this problem in the first place is that light is entering in and bouncing straight off the back, it's that these flashes are too level with the entrance of the light. So they are too close to where the light is also going to be entering in. So it's not a big angle here, so it's very easy for light to just reflect back into the lens. So one way that hopefully is more obvious now because of these context clues is that you can move the light up. You can move it up or to the right or just in some direction, and as you move it up, one of the things that's going to happen is that that light is going to reflect differently. So if the light is coming from all the way up here, and it's coming down like this, it may reflect back, but it's not going to reflect back into our lens. So this is one of the ways that we can really do this, that we can really eliminate red eye, is by using what's called a flash bracket, or by holding the lens off of the camera, or rather the flash off of the camera, and trying to get some elevation to it, trying to make it so that it doesn't look, so that the light doesn't reflect directly off of the back of the retina. There's a variety of ways, and many of them are really variations of just moving the light elsewhere, moving it away from the built-in flash that exists here. And so you could try some other tricks as well, like blinding your subjects temporarily with some very, very bright light, something like that. Or what might also work is not having them look directly into the camera. So in this picture, you know, they're looking directly at me, and this is going to be a problem. I mean, yes, I can move the flash off camera, but if that is not available to me, another option I have is to recompose them, move them somewhere so that they're not actually looking at the camera. And not only would I possibly get a more interesting shot, but I will also eliminate this red eye. Okay, so the next problem is this harsh light. So I mentioned that we have these very harsh shadows that exist directly behind them. And this also can be corrected by moving the flash off of the camera. So if you have the flash that's right up top and you try to move it some number of inches away, This also has the side benefit not only of reducing the amount of red eye that you will get, but also changing the way the shadows are reacting, or the way that the shadows are presenting themselves within your photo. So if you imagine that you are letting off a certain amount of light directly in front of or directly on top of the lens, as that light hits the person, that shadow is going to happen, you know, very quickly after them. But if you lift the light source up above the person, then what happens is that the light is coming down this way and the shadows basically move under the frame. It's hard to explain this in sort of 3D terms, but if I'm standing here, they don't happen sort of right behind me. They're perhaps more to the floor, if that makes sense, because the light is coming from here rather than from over here. So now all of this light is down here and hopefully away from the image that I am taking right here immediately. So now I can eliminate those also by moving the flash off of the camera. And unfortunately, while with red eye you can use other methods to try to reduce it, you know, through a variety of tips and tricks by moving the person, etc., this is much harder thing to try to combat. If there's not a lot of light behind them, if they're not sufficiently lit behind, it's just going to be very, very difficult for you to try to combat this harsh light, these harsh shadows anyway. Okay, so I even mentioned that there was yet another problem with this image as well, and that was that this flash did not even do what it was supposed to do, and that is stop the motion. So they are still blurry, the background is still blurry, so what happened here? So rather than this camera using the fast shutter speed, that, you know, that sync speed that I mentioned before, which is about 1/250th of a second, though this at the time this was a compact digital camera that I took this photo with, it used a much slower shutter speed. So this could be using that night portrait mode, for example. So it thought, okay, well, I'm going to, with night portrait, I might take a flash photo so that I can expose the subjects properly. And then also I will have a long shutter speed to try to capture the light that exists in the background. And this is very, very difficult to do, no matter how you slice it, even if you have a tripod. So in this case, I didn't have a tripod. I was hand holding it. So with a slow shutter speed and a flash that was right near the lens, you can see why I got the exact result that I did. Not that this would really be an interesting photo to everyone else, you know, just because it's my brother and sister standing in some sand. I mean, what can I say? But anyway, so even if I had a tripod and I set it up and I took the time to make sure, you know, I set the mirror lock up and I made sure that it was absolutely positively still, and I took this photo and it fires the flash and it has a long shutter speed, no matter how still my brother and sister are, especially since they are, let's see, 2002, so they were probably about 5 and 6 at the time, they're still going to be fidgeting a little bit, like, can I move now? And so you will still get a little bit of light that makes them soft as well. So it's very difficult to get a flash photo at night where you get the subjects absolutely still, even though flash can be used to sort of to stop motion, as we mentioned, because there's this other light that exists. You will still see this movement that exists. So the only time that you can really stop motion is if it's absolutely dark. Yes?
The other slide that you had where a bullet went through the object.
So went through the object.
Was desirable, right? Right there.
So this really is meant to stop motion. And considering that this is a bullet flying through an apple, I think Dr. Edgerton actually did a pretty good job. But the reason that we don't see any motion blur is that there was no other light that existed in this room. It was completely, completely dark. So only the flash was used to illuminate a certain moment in time, and that is what was recorded on film. If there was even so much as a little bit of light and there was a long shutter speed, then we would probably see a bit of motion blur, but also, you know, with an emphasis on this exact moment in time, if that makes sense. Because we have a little bit of light that's reflecting off of all of these things while the apple was still intact and while the bullet was still firing. But because we've made the room completely dark and fired the flash at this exact moment, we now have only captured that one moment in time, no other moments. The shutter speed is probably pretty low here. I don't know what it actually is, but it could be on the order of minutes, frankly. Just because if there's no other light, it doesn't matter how long the shutter speed is, it's only going to capture the light that's given off by the flash here. So it's only even if it's a long shutter speed, and you can still get a very fast moment in time. Okay. All right, so now if you have this problem, which is called slow sync, by the way, where you have not only a flash, but also a somewhat long shutter speed, you have quite a bit to combat with. So that is something certainly to keep in mind. So you absolutely must have a tripod when you're using a slow sync. And realize, though, that when you're using flash, part of the reason that it's appealing is that we can illuminate objects in the room without needing a tripod to begin with, because it enhances the amount of light that exists there. But what we are talking about here are more advanced techniques, reasons why you might need a tripod when using a flash, and that is for using, as always, very, very long shutter speeds that happen. So there is actually additional effects that can happen when you're taking flash photos. So as you remember, I mentioned that there's two curtains that basically open and then close in succession in order to, show light or to allow light to enter into the sensor or the film. So if we have a relatively long shutter speed, so maybe one that's slightly longer than the sync speed, for example, so that means that the first curtain opens and it stays open for some amount of time, then the next shutter closes, we can actually have two different periods of time when the flash can fire, and each one will produce a different result. So in this case, we can combine this sort of motion blur with a still object, and realize that all that's happening in these two photos is that we have a somewhat long shutter speed and there's a flash firing somewhere in the middle. And what's happening is that if we open the first curtain and we fire the flash, and then we wait a little bit of time, and then we close the second curtain, what might happen if we have this sort of bright light that's zooming by, as would be the case on this motorcycle? So we would actually get this first image that's on the left here, where we have very quickly opened the first curtain and fired the flash, which means that we have frozen this exact moment in time. But as we've kept the shutter open for a little bit longer, that means that that motorcycle was able to move off screen or off image, and therefore you get this sort of, it looks like he's reversing, but he's not. This is actually a first curtain sync, what's called a first curtain sync, because the camera is synchronizing the exact moment when the first curtain opens, then it fires the flash, and then it waits just a little bit of time in order to close the second curtain. Was there a question?
Yeah, why is the streak only of the light and not of the object also?
Why is the streak only of the light and not of the object also? Because the rest of the object is too dark to be visible for these particular exposure settings. So only the light is bright enough to register through whatever f-stop and ISO settings they had used in this particular case. It would require a higher ISO or a lower F number to try to get the rest of the object visible in this particular case. Now, that's just this particular example. It is possible, if you have even lighting, to get the same sort of effect with the object as a whole. But in this case, it was just exaggerated using this extra bright light, the brake light that's on this motorcycle, to exaggerate this particular effect of shutter speed, or rather of curtain sync. So I know it's, let's see. So just keep in mind that the rest of this object is very, very dark, because remember, what you are seeing is the illuminated object from the flash only, and other times it's just too dark to register for the sensor to register that particular object. You can only see, so to speak, the light that is bright enough for it to register. Okay, so we also then have a rear curtain sync, or a second curtain sync, where we open the shutter So the first curtain opens, and then we have some amount of time where, you know, that shutter is completely open, and then we fire the flash and then close the second shutter, or the second curtain immediately. And that is this result here. So that's because after we open the first curtain, we are allowing motion blur to happen. So this motorcycle has moved into the image. Then, right when we're about to close the shutter, we fire the flash. And as we fire the flash, we get that object at the very end of its motion, and then we close the curtain. So all the difference here is when the flash is firing. So if we fire the flash first and allow the object to move, then we're going to make it look like it's moving in reverse, just because this flash is fired and then the motorcycle is moved on. But if we fire the flash last, then the motion will move to wherever it is, the flash will fire, and then that's where we will see the result. So if you want to get, you know, a photo that's like this, where you have to have a slow curtain sink, and in other words, you have a long shutter speed with some amount of light in the scene, and you need to illuminate that or provide additional illumination with the flash, then most of the time you will probably want to use a second curtain sink or a rear curtain sink. Yes?
Should the license plate not have a trail on it though?
Is that one? The license plate, yes, so shouldn't the license plate not have a trail on the second one? So presumably there is additional illumination happening here. So license plates are usually pretty reflective, so there could be additional light that's off camera to the left maybe that's providing some additional illumination. If you look closely, you do also see that same trail in this first photo as well. So there, it's not a trick of the flash or anything like that. It's just more prominent in this particular case, but there is something that's illuminating that that license plate more than the rest of the motorcycle, whether that's the lights that are built into it or it's reflecting additional light that's off camera. It's tough to tell, but it's probably a combination of both. Okay, any other questions about curtain sink? All right, so yes, you can imagine that there's even more stuff that we can do with flash, and that is that if you have relatively long shutter speed and you take multiple flash, you can get this sort of stroboscopic effect. So you can have this effect where if you have, even for, you know, a split second where somebody is hitting a tennis ball with a tennis racket, and this again is a photo by Dr. Edgerton. He was sort of the master of flash photography, especially early on. This was this particular photo was from 1949. But anyway, if you have a flash that's capable of producing many unique or many individual flashes in a burst of sorts, so it just very quickly is flashing, 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 flashing like this, then you can get this sort of effect here where you can stop motion of a particular object throughout its motion range. So you just are firing this flash multiple times very, very, very quickly. And usually we don't get this sort of effect in sort of our day-to-day flash units, but higher-end flash units will typically have this sort of capability for you to take a photo just like this. So even common flash units have, particularly ones that are from specific manufacturers, so if you have a Canon camera or you have a Nikon camera and you buy a flash unit that's specific to that particular format, then they usually have what's called a high-speed sync option. And so for all of my talk of being unable to take a photo at a shutter speed that is faster than your X-sync speed, what these flashes can actually do is an effect that's similar to this. So it fires multiple times very, very quickly, but it just puts these flashes closer together so that it's a longer amount of time that this flash is outputting light. Then that means that then we can have a faster shutter speed, because then we don't have this problem with curtains getting in the way, et cetera. And we can use what's called a high sync speed to try to take a photo that is faster than our fastest X sync speed. This is not meant to be confusing. You might say, well, why do we need a longer amount of flash if we're going to get, you know, a faster shutter speed? And remember that if by going back a little bit and looking again at this, as soon as we get any shutter speed that is faster than this X-sync speed, we're at a specific moment in time, some portion of the image is actually going to be blocked off. So in order for us to make sure that we get the entire thing properly exposed, we have to make sure that the flash lasts for the duration of the time that those curtains are moving across. And so that's why we need a slightly longer time in what high-end flashes are capable of doing. But you don't need a high-end flash to take flash photos, to do a lot of the things that you need. In fact, this one, I don't even know how old this is, but this is an old Vivitar 3500. I think it's at least probably 15 or 20 years old now. It's pretty ancient, but you can use these old flashes on your new cameras. So for example, this Vivitar, let's see, this was a 283. These old Vivitar 283s were actually very, very popular with hobbyists that take digital photos and want to have the sort of manual control over them. So when you're taking photos on your digital camera with a flash that's like this, then generally what you will do is set your camera at the X-sync speed, because that's the fastest shutter speed you can take it at. Then you have to just sort of learn, you have to look at the guide number, and usually there's a little bit of a graph back here that helps you figure out, okay, this flash has this much power and I'm using these settings, and so I can therefore take a photo that's this far away. And then you can use an older flash unit in sort of a manual fashion on your digital camera. Now there's something that you have to watch out for, and that is that these older flashes, they have electrical contacts here on what's called the hot shoe mount, and that's just the mount that attaches the flash to the top of the camera. It's a very common mount, and you've probably seen it before. But the older flashes can have very, very high voltages across those contacts that can damage modern digital cameras. So before you use any old flash on your camera, I recommend that you actually take a look at one particular website that has compiled a lot of information about old flashes, and it will actually tell you the voltage. And usually, usually having a flash that is capable of a voltage of about 6 volts or less is safe to use on your camera. So anyway, there's this big table where they have a variety of flash manufacturers and flash models, and they tell you whether or not it is safe to use on a typical digital camera. And in fact, this is something, if you're electrically inclined, this is something you can test yourself by turning on your flash unit, waiting for it to charge up, using a voltmeter to determine the volts across the electrical contacts. And if it is higher than about 5 or 6 volts, then I recommend not using it on your digital camera unless you're absolutely sure that it is capable of supporting that high of a voltage. But anyway, I'll post a link to this off of the lectures page, because this is something that is probably useful and certainly interesting to know. And I don't want any of you frying your camera because I recommend using an old flash. But anyway, with these old flashes, what's really neat about them is that you can get some relatively inexpensive equipment to actually move it off of the camera. So this flash does have a very typical hot shoe mount where I could mount it on top of the camera and use it there, but that doesn't offer a lot of interesting ways that I can use this flash. By using what's called a PC cord, and only a few SLRs have this, you'll have to make sure that yours supports it, you can use what's called a PC cord to connect to a flash unit like this, and then you can just have like a separate light stand for it, for example, and move the flash off camera. So now you can get interesting angles out of this light. You can do interesting things with this light that just was not possible by having it mounted purely on your camera. If you're interested in this sort of thing, there's a website, or it's really rather a blog, but it's a website that has gained quite a bit of popularity called Strobist. And these people, it may actually be just a couple of people that manage this, but they have quite a following. But most of these people use digital cameras with manual flashes like this in very much an off-camera situation to take some absolutely stunning photos that just are not possible otherwise. So that one's not, you know, it's a YouTube video, so it's not terribly great, but just photos that you would not normally expect. Oh, come on, give me one. So something like this, for example. This one is pretty neat of the shuttle taking off back in September 18th, it looks like, and how these people have actually taken photos that look like this using just a couple of off-camera flashes and their digital camera. And so this is something that's very neat and definitely worth exploring. Now, you can use flashes for more than just really creative outlets. They can actually be extremely useful, if it's going to come up, to enhance the amount of light that exists within a scene. So let's say that you are taking a photo of a scene and you have very harsh lighting, or it's somewhat heavily backlit, and you need to provide additional illumination to a subject that is reasonably close to you. Then in this case, it's usually okay to use the flash that exists on your camera to provide additional illumination. So in this case, you can more evenly light portions of the image just because of their proximity. So in this case, this was a perfect candidate for additional fill flash because the object was relatively close, it was backlit, and you can use it to just make sure that you get a very even amount of light that exists. Because while in software you can later go back and fix something that looks like this, it's going to be a lot more difficult. The downside, obviously, is that you will get the same sorts of problems that exist before, such as harsh flash reflections that can exist. And so you'll have to be careful with that particular aspect of it. But using fill flash is really, really vital and really important to be able to get properly exposed photographs sort of in the midday when there's very harsh lighting and there's going to be very harsh shadows. So in this particular case, the sun, as you can see, was providing some very harsh light, but by adding some fill flash, you can remove a lot of those harsh shadows that exist on a subject's face and make it a lot more even so that you can get some much more evenly lit photographs. And so remember here, of course, that you have to be careful with light fall off because the subject does have to be within a certain range in order for you to be able to fill, to provide enough light to fill the darker regions with flash, with fill flash appropriately. But one of the things that you may find is an even bigger hindrance to this, to fill flash, is that X-sync speed. So remember that I said that the maximum speed that you can use when taking a flash photo is about 1/250th of a second. And that's a big problem when you're taking a photograph during the daytime, because something that's as bright as this is going to be very difficult. You're going to have to really use some high F numbers and some low ISOs to try to get the exposure values to fit within the sync speed. And in this case, I had to make the F number F11 and make the ISO 100 in order to be able to make the camera have a slow enough shutter speed at 1/250th of a second. So this is where having an additional level of or additional speed for the sync speed can become quite handy, because then you are able to take a photo in the daylight and use fill flash a lot more effectively. And so this is something that you really do have to be careful with. So flash photography is something that's really useful. You can use it, as I mentioned, for fill flash. You can use it for providing additional light for subjects. And one of the things I really recommend once you move beyond this class, because we don't really focus on it too much in the assignments, is that you work on using some off-camera lighting on your flash, because it really provides this additional level of control to your scenes that you just have not had before. But also, it gives this extra dimension. So I mentioned all of this. I mentioned before that I had this stigma against using flash lighting for a long time because it was very harsh, it's very unnatural. But by moving the camera by moving the flash off of the camera, you have so much additional control over it that it really becomes quite acceptable and really quite fun to be able to light objects with just a flash. And you can do some really amazing things with off-camera flash. And again, you don't have to purchase anything, but if you're interested in this, look at that Strobist website. Again, I'll post a link to it online, but just with a couple of relatively inexpensive cords and adapters, you can get even a normal flash like this to be able to be used off camera. And just so that it's clear, this cord will actually control the flash, and more specifically, it'll fire the flash off camera, so that when I take a photo using the camera, then it will fire the flash elsewhere. And this can be really useful and really quite fun. But that's it for flash, and I look forward to seeing you next week when we continue talking about digital photography.